Good day, and welcome to the Cigna Eating Disorder Awareness Series conference call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Kate Hartner. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome, and thank you, everyone, for calling in to Cigna's 2014 Eating Disorder Awareness Series. My name is Kate Hartner, and I'm a care manager on the Eating Disorder team with Cigna. Due to the format of the call today, you'll not be able to ask questions during the teleconference. However, at the end of the conference, there will be a brief five-question survey in which we are requesting your feedback on your experience of today's seminar. After that survey, you will be able to ask questions of today's speaker. A handout for the presentation is available online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorders and College Students Making Peace with the Freshman 15. Once again, visit the Awareness Series page online at www.cigna.com/eatingdisorders. Halfway down the page under the heading Current Topics, you'll see the link for today's presentation in blue entitled Eating Disorders and College Students Making Peace with the Freshman 15. Please also notice the blue square in the top section of the page that you may click on to sign up for future seminars. It's not required that you sign up in order to attend each month. However, if you choose to sign up, you will receive an email reminder for each month's presentation. Today I have the pleasure of introducing our speaker, Dr. Sarah Chips. Dr. Chips is the lead therapist at Montanito's Eating Disorder Treatment of New York. Today she'll be sharing information with us on eating disorders in the college-age population. Welcome, Dr. Chips.
Hi, thank you, Kate. I'm, as Kate said, I'm Dr. Sarah Chips. I am a clinical psychologist. I have a PsyD, which is a doctorate in clinical psychology. I have a private practice in Manhattan where I primarily treat people with eating disorders, and then I'm the lead therapist at Montanito's Eating Disorder Treatment of New York, which is a partial hospitalization program and an intensive IOP program for people with eating disorders, primarily adults, so we do take adolescents ages 14 and up. I've also worked in college counseling centers. I worked at the University of San Francisco for a year, and I worked at the University of Nevada, Reno for a year. At the University of Nevada, Reno, I worked on a multidisciplinary eating disorder treatment team with other therapists, physicians, and nutritionists who provided complete services for the student population who had eating disorders there if they were appropriate to be seen at the outpatient level of care. Because we didn't have opportunities to send many of our clients to treatment there. And by the way, I'm going to start working off of the slides that are on the website. So I'm on slide 2 right now. So if you want to go to slide 2 and see a picture of me, I'm there. As I said, I work at Montanito's Eating Disorder Treatment of New York, and I'm also a recovered therapist. That means that I once had an eating disorder, and I've now fully recovered from that eating disorder. When I was in college, I suffered from anorexia nervosa for the first 3 years of my college experience. So I have both clinical expertise and personal experience with the topic that I'm going to be discussing today. And I'm going to move on to the third slide. Just some facts about eating disorders and people who are suffering from them and college students. So this first fact comes from NEDA, from the National Eating Disorder Association. If you don't know about NEDA, it's the leading nonprofit organization in the United States that advocates on behalf of and supports individuals and families affected by eating disorders. They're an amazing organization, and I encourage you to check out their NEDA walks and their website if this topic is important to you. So 20 million women and approximately 10 million men suffer from eating disorders in the United States. This second fact, 1 in 5 women struggle with an eating disorder or disordered eating. This comes from the National Institute of Mental Health. This is a 2009 fact. It notes two separate labels, eating disorders and disordered eating. And these are a little bit different. So disordered eating occurs when a person's attitudes about food, weight, and body size lead to rigid eating and exercise habits that jeopardize one's health, happiness, and or safety. That's how I define it. But an eating disorder occurs when disordered eating progresses, and the sufferer meets criteria set forth in the DSM, the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, for an eating disorder. So people may have disordered eating, but not meet the full criteria for the diagnosis of an eating disorder. Eating disorders, let's see, eating disorders affect up to 24 million Americans and 70 million individuals worldwide. Eating disorders are problematic across cultures. So eating, and by cultures I mean socioeconomic, gender-defined cultures, sexual orientation, and ethnicity. There's evidence that the rate of eating disorders in a culture increases with exposure to Western industrialized country media. If you know about the Fiji study that Ann Becker facilitated around television and the introduction of television in 1995 to the Fijian population, you'll know that within 3 years, the rates of bulimia in that population, once nil, had risen to rates that were comparable to those of industrialized nations. So media and culture definitely play a part in helping people to develop eating disorders. But as I'll talk about later, they're not the only factor for sure. An estimated 10 to 15% of people with anorexia or bulimia are male. So this is a population that's receiving more attention. Once considered a primarily female problem, eating disorders are now being more understood that they're occurring in male populations. But males with eating disorders, especially male athletes, may use symptoms that are typically different than those that we see in female sufferers. So they also tend to deny that their behavior is related to an eating disorder and less likely to report symptoms and seek help for them. So when I was working in college counseling centers, I remember male students coming to me and talking about binging and purging, but not relating that to a problematic behavior, saying, you know, sometimes I just eat too much and then I make myself throw up, but not understanding or wanting to connect that to being eating disordered. Men constitute 40% of those suffering from binge eating disorder. And it's estimated that nearly 20% of college students, both males and females, have eating disorders. Now, I want to say something about the binge eating disorder that I just mentioned about the men being 40% of those suffering. This was a 1994 finding from a NIM study, a National Institute of Mental Health study, and this was before binge eating disorder was actually recognized as a codable eating disorder in the DSM. But in the last year, binge eating disorder has been codified and is now being recognized more as a real eating disorder. But there's still a lot of stigma around binge eating disorders. And I hear it in my clients, and I hear it in their families' messages, too. And I want to, I guess, just note that binge eating disorder is just another way that people use food to manipulate or help them deal with their feelings, and that it is a mental disorder that we can treat, and not just overeating or being gluttonous. So I want to go to the next slide. And here is my portrayal of some social and cultural factors that I kind of witnessed today in my younger, some influences that my younger clients find important to them. Now, this cover, this Cosmopolitan cover that I've chosen, this is actually the newest Cosmopolitan cover. It's from the September 2014 edition. And Cosmo is the most read magazine among college women. So that's why I think this is important. If we look closely at it, we can see that there's a focus on sex. There's three cover stories, Best Sex Ever, The New Orgasms, and It's Sex O'Clock. And then there's two cover stories that really drive home the importance of image and body image. The Hey Pretty, Get Tight and Toned Fast, introducing the Cosmo body. And then there's the 7 Days to Gorgeous Skin cover story. This Cosmo body situation is especially interesting to me because I think it's, well, it's definitely pointing readers to the internet. And this is a venue that I didn't have access to or wasn't available in the same way when I was in college, 14 years ago, 15 years ago. So the internet and Facebook and Instagram and all of the images and the social media influences that our young people today are accessing are really increasing, I think, the focus on body image and the comparison culture among women and young men. Okay, let's see. I've got a lot of stuff to say about this cover. So this Cosmo body fit situation that they have, if you go to their website, you'll see that it's a new fitness and lifestyle channel, and subscribers can access unlimited workouts with celebrity trainers. And you can check it out. It's at cosmobody.com. This is something that I see a lot of my young clients, especially once they've gone off to college, abusing. And for some kids, it can be a really healthy thing. They can do workouts with their friends at home in their dorm room or at their friends' apartments, and they can do it together as a social activity. But what I see my clients, the ones with eating disorders, doing is isolating and over-exercising by themselves using online exercise videos. So this kind of heightened my interest. And if you go to the website, it doesn't say, like, get healthier faster. They promote, it says get hotter faster. So this body image and what we look like has really become the most important thing in this culture. Now I've kind of talked around this image of the woman in the center. And this woman here, arguably beautiful young lady in revealing clothes, just kind of gripping the hem of her dress in a seductive fashion. Her name is Lucy Hale, and it says that she is breaking the cycle of insecurity. She actually revealed in a 2012 Cosmo interview that she had suffered from anorexia nervosa, but had since established a healthy relationship with food and exercise. I don't take issue with women in recovery looking good and owning their sexual power. I think it's really great, actually, and I think that it's really positive to have some models of recovery out. But I also think that if celebrity models kind of promoting this image of recovery is all that our young people have to look to as models of recovery, then that that can be problematic, because these people are made up, exercised, fed, photoshopped by a team of professionals. So I think it's one of the reasons that I am open about my own recovery, is that I want to help provide my clients with a different model of recovery, if you will. I'm going to move away from that Cosmo cover and go to the top right image, this selfie picture. This is a music video that came out recently. The title of the song is hashtag selfie, and the music artists who do this song call themselves the Chainsmokers. The song, if you listen to it, reflects and promotes a really vapid message glamorizing vanity and self-obsession. And these cultural messages can initiate and drive a dangerous pursuit of thinness and really are a crippling promise that external beauty is the most tangible and predictable way to achieve love and social status. And that leads me to this bottom right picture, which I borrowed this from a pro-anorexia website, which is another way that kids are using the internet to really access dangerous messages. It says, because the pain of looking in the mirror hurts more than starving. And this sums up the truth of what I hear from my clients, sadly, that dieting, distorted eating, and eating disorders deceptively promise to save them from the emotional pain of perceiving themselves as physically unattractive. Now, I realize that this slide that we're looking at could perpetuate the myth that eating disorders are female phenomena, and they are not. As I've mentioned before, men are under similar and increasing body image social pressure. The cultural ideal for the male body, though, the male body shape favors an athletic, upper body V-shaped and muscular frame. And gay men are just in general weigh significantly less and are more likely to be underweight and to desire an underweight ideal weight. And they're less satisfied with their bodies than their heterosexual counterparts. They're at an increasing risk for eating disorders. Now, we can switch to the next slide, where we have a picture of a coal miner holding a canary. So I wanted to talk about why, if the culture in which our young people grow up in is so bad, doesn't everybody develop an eating disorder? So this is a metaphor that the founder of the company that I work for, Carolyn Costin, who's an amazing woman and has written several books and is also a recovered therapist, uses when she talks about this phenomenon. And I'm going to read you a quote from her. In many ways, we can view individuals who develop eating disorders as our cultural canaries in the coal mine. Before more advanced alert systems existed, coal miners would take canaries down into the mines to serve as warning signals. If the canaries died or became ill, this signaled to the miners long before they would have detected a problem that the environment was toxic and they needed to get out. Like the canaries, individuals who develop eating disorders may be our songbirds, warning us that our current environment is toxic and that we all need to take heed. Not everyone exposed to the cultural obsession with appearance will develop an eating disorder. Not everyone who smokes will get lung cancer either. But for every person who does, there are hundreds more who hate their bodies, destructively diet, and engage in eating in disordered eating and lead unfulfilled lives. So genetics play a huge part in eating disorder development and the maintenance of eating disorders. is what we're finding out, as do neurotransmitters. So specifically neurotransmitters such as serotonin, norepinephrine, endogenous opioids, and beta endorphin. And so this fact really emphasizes to me the need for psychiatric evaluation and prescription in a and prescription of psychopharmacological help in most eating disorder cases. So I'm going to switch to the next slide. And on this slide, I point to five personality traits of people with eating disorders. And they're obsessive, perfectionistic, anxious, novelty-seeking, and impulsive. Now, these are five traits that you'll probably see in children who later develop eating disorders. And I can tell you that I had many of these traits. I was less novelty-seeking and impulsive as I was obsessive, perfectionistic, and anxious. And you can probably tell in my voice today that I'm still an anxious person, and I'm still perfectionistic, and sometimes I'm still obsessive. So these traits don't necessarily go away, but they're always going to be part of, like, my core self and every eating disordered person's core self. So I was going to share with you a story of something that happened when I was in preschool, just to let you know how far back I remember experiencing these traits. So I remember it was recess time. I was standing in a sandbox with a bunch of other children, and I remember thinking suddenly that it would be fun to kick the sand in the sandbox really hard. So I did, and the sand flew all over the preschool. One of the teachers was standing in front of me that I hadn't considered, but she happened to be facing the other way. And it wasn't my intention to kick sand on anyone. I was really just trying to have a little sand party for myself. But she turned around and she said, really angrily, "Who kicked sand?" And I froze, and I tried to look innocent and to indicate that I hadn't done it. I must have been 3 or 4. But she believed that I hadn't done it because it was outside of my normal behavior. Usually I was conservative and a really good girl in class. And I didn't get caught. But as soon as she turned around, I took off running in the other direction, and I found a bush in the playground, and I hid in it, and I cried by myself. So even in preschool, I sensed that I was different from other children, that I was shyer, as more anxious, and I really couldn't tolerate being corrected or reprimanded by adults. I only felt safe if I was behaving perfectly in public. And now, I don't think that my anxious, perfectionistic, obsessive nature was any fault of my parents, actually. And some therapists have tried to talk me into my parents being at fault, but I think that this kind of disposition just runs in my family. And there's actually research going on, specifically research that I've looked at is at UCSD, at the University of California, San Diego, that is proving that the brains of people with eating disorders are different. And they have some excellent information on their website. You should check it out if you haven't looked at the UCSD website and Walter Kay's research. So these same traits that allowed me to obsess over calories and check my body, demanding nothing less than perfection of myself, and kept me isolated with overwhelming social fear were the same ones that helped me to earn excellent grades in college, be discerning and meticulous in researching for my dissertation, and to tenaciously seek employment at the facility that I consider the best in the country. I really wanted to work at Montanito. So these traits can be liabilities when driving and eating disorder, but they've become assets to me in other areas of my life. So as I said, I'm not going to change these things about myself, but I can certainly choose to use them either for good or evil if I have awareness over them. I'm going to turn to the next slide and talk about interpersonal factors that kind of drive eating disorders. My perfectionistic, anxious, obsessive personality kept me isolated and feeling misunderstood from a really early age. People in relationships were really scary to me, and they're scary for a lot of my clients. People in relationships are unpredictable. People have faults and baggage of their own. To quote an eating disorder sufferer, she said, "Anorexia became my best friend. It gave me comfort and separated me from the scary world of socializing. I didn't have anything else on my mind." Often the scariest and riskiest relationships are romantic ones. This is especially true for our young college-bound adults who have little experience with dating. So I'm going to read an excerpt from Jenny Schaefer's book, Life Without Ed, which is a great book. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to pick up a copy of it. And I think this captures the experience of many people with eating disorders. In this book, Jenny names her eating disorder Ed, and she describes how her relationship with Ed became abusive and all-encompassing. She writes, "I just recently started dating a guy named Scott. Ed is jealous and wants me back as his lovely, devoted wife. In order to convince me to go back with him, Ed says, 'Jenny, if you come back to me, you can avoid having to deal with this relationship with Scott. With me in your life, you won't have to think about all of those things that come along with a relationship, like feelings and sexuality. Come on, give me another chance.'" So this for a lot of my clients, their relationship with their eating disorder, with this voice that drives the maladaptive behavior patterns with food, this becomes their primary relationship, and it blocks them from intimacy, real intimacy with other people. And sometimes that can feel safe. Because eating is an interpersonal experience from birth, it makes sense that food is one way of managing the stress of not getting interpersonal needs met. Another pretty obvious way that young people use food to manage social needs has to do with body image. If we go back to the media portrayals of what is attractive in one of the earlier slides, we can conclude that thinness and beauty will bring us love, and also success and happiness and power. Now, this last point, teasing and bullying. This is interesting. I just saw a study from the North Dakota State University. They surveyed people with eating disorders, and they asked them to rank the things that they felt had led to their eating disorder. Now, the respondents indicated that from their experience, what they felt was the reason, not what researchers or theorists thought was the reason, but they felt that social problems like peer pressure and bullying contributed more to the development of their eating disorder than culture or media. And this was actually true. This was part of my story and the development of my eating disorder, was that I was teased and bullied for being a little bit bigger in elementary school. So I can certainly understand that. Now let's look at the next slide. Why college students? Because leaving high school and home to a new city, new school, and new social environment is really stressful. Eating disorders provide an illusion of control and a tangible focus for manipulation, which is the body. So when things are feeling out of control for my clients, they can always turn to their relationship with food and their body, to gain a sense of control and mastery. And that can feel very safe and soothing, and can be very dangerous and really, really help perpetuate the eating disorder. Now, college students are inherently at a point of negotiating their power and agency in the world. But with the freedom of independence also comes responsibility. So my college-age students really stress about financial responsibility, whether or not that responsibility or those demands have been put on them by their family. A lot of them feel like burdens and guilty for taking up family resources. They have confusion over understanding their own value system and developing their own identity as opposed to maintaining the identity that they had in childhood or maintaining the values of their parents. And the stress of taking care of themselves for the first time, like doing their own laundry, buying their own books, feeding themselves in a new kitchen or a new cafeteria where there's crazy amounts and varieties of foods, can be really overwhelming. So eating disorders can provide a dangerous distraction from these stresses. It provides like a singular goal and a simple identity for them. I've already talked about how social pressures and culture are influential in the development of eating disorders, but I think it's important to note that a focus on friends and socializing is developmentally appropriate for college-aged adults. However, for those with the genetic predisposition to developing an eating disorder, food manipulation can quickly become a preferred coping mechanism when confronted by the stresses of early adulthood. I think there's also a lot of social pressure on kids going to college to have fun and that these are going to be the best years of their lives. And for a lot of kids, it's not. That doesn't really validate their experience. It can be really hard and really scary. So that can feel also alienating when that's the message you've been getting for a long time. Now I want to talk about some red flags. I'm not going to go into, you know, all the diagnostic criteria for anorexia, bulimia, and binge eating disorder, but instead I want to look at, like, disordered eating red flags, because I think that that's even more important and more kind of tangible to understand for parents and loved ones of people with eating disorders. So on the first slide, I have restricting red flags. So red flags that your loved one or your child may be restricting their food. So weight loss, this is one of the first things that parents notice. A preoccupation with food, nutrition, weight, or body image. So they're talking about exercise. They're talking about their body shape. They're talking about calories or nutrients or what's good for you and what's bad for you. Refusing certain foods, especially if they previously really liked these foods. So the types of food that they eat become smaller, more rigid. Food rituals. Now, this could look like cutting their food up into little pieces. It could be hiding food. It could be tearing food up. There's just anything that feels necessary to the sufferer to do with their food, that if they don't do it, their anxiety gets heightened. Excessive and rigid exercise routine, this is common among college kids who now have, if they've gone off to college, have access to time and to the gym that they might not have had at home. Rigid, inflexible thinking behavior, resists eating with others or says, oh, I already ate. And then the mood, depressed, anxious, yet emotionally restrained, maybe difficult to talk about or express anger or messier emotions. And actually, social isolation should be on this restricting red flag. The next slide, purging red flags. So bathroom trips after eating, the smell of vomit in the bathroom. Noticing that they're using laxatives or diuretics, or that there's laxative or diuretic packages in the garbage. Excessive exercise, again. Social isolation, again, which is listed twice on this purging red flag, but I think one of them should have gone on the other one. Excessive use of mouthwash or mints. Swollen cheeks. So this is kind of the lower cheeks get swollen from purging. And a preoccupation, again, same kind of preoccupation with the body image, weight, and food. And then the binge eating red flags on the next slide. So weight gain as opposed to weight loss. Evidence of binge eating. And this might also be, the binging and the purging can either go together or like I said about binge eating disorder, the binge can be separate. Evidence of binge eating with like wrappers or food missing from cupboards and stealing or hoarding food. So let's turn to the next slide. Early prevention and intervention. So when I'm working with families, I'm always encouraging them to cultivate a healthy family culture around food, exercise, and body image. And I think this is easier said than done because we all live in this coal mine, and we've all been influenced by the same culture that our kids do. A lot of parents are on diets. And what I tell families is that dieting doesn't work. There are numerous studies that have shown that diets are ineffective and can be harmful. While you might lose weight temporarily by dieting, weight is almost always regained once the diet ends, and it can lead to a pattern of disordered eating, slowed metabolism, and unhealthy weight fluctuation. Then 35% of normal dieters progress to pathological dieting. And of those people who progress to pathological dieting, 20 to 25% of them progress to partial or full syndrome eating disorders. So I think of dieting as the gateway to eating disorders. I tell people if you don't diet, you can't get an eating disorder. So just don't do it if you want to avoid that. So I also try to get families to promote intuitive eating. There are no good foods and bad foods. All foods are good in moderation. And this is really scary for a lot of families who have food myths about fats or candy, sugar. I get a lot of fear from families around these things, carbohydrates. I also encourage families to ban fat talk from their home. Now, when I say fat talk, I'm referring to positive or negative comments about appearance and dieting that belittles the speaker, and this is prevalent on college campuses. I hear this all the time. I shouldn't have eaten that. If you're fat, if you think you're fat, then I must be huge, or I feel fat, right? Like fat is an emotional feeling. And then I try to get families to promote positive body image messages like, I appreciate my body for what it does for me, the functionality of my body. Or just, giving yourself some cheerleading statements like, I look good today. My body deserves to be nourished with food. I deserve that. I deserve to live. And switching to the next slide. First steps toward recovery. So if you suspect that your child or loved one is struggling with an eating disorder, I encourage you to be direct and honest with them about what you're seeing. I don't believe in elephants in the room. I want to talk about anything that's there, right? I no secrets about that. If you see that they're restricting or that you suspect that they're purging, say it out loud. And the next step is to get assessed by eating disorder specialists. So it could be a psychiatrist, a therapist, or a physician. And if there is a problem, if the assessment comes back positive, then at minimum, you want a psychiatrist, a therapist, a physician, and a dietitian. Because eating disorders are tied in with our bodies, they're really medical conditions, and they require a multidisciplinary team. And then levels of care. Now, your team can recommend different levels of care. So whether that be outpatient, so you're just seeing that team, intensive outpatient, where they're coming to a the patient is coming to a program of like 3 to 5 times a week for several hours at a time. Partial hospitalization, which is like a day treatment program like what we have at Montanito here. So the clients come for 6 to 8 hours a day, and they have a lot of meals and snacks here, and also group therapy and individual therapy and nutritional counseling here. Residential care, where they're at a facility that may be like a house. It might look like a comfortable house, and they live there and get all of their care there, or inpatient hospitalization for the most severe cases that really require 24/7 nursing care. Okay. And last slide. How college can help. Now, if your child or yourself, I'm kind of talking to parents because I'm assuming that's who's calling in, but if it's yourself, you want to ask certain questions of the college, I think, at orientation or ahead of time before you get there. So there should be campus resources, the counseling center, student services center, the residential people, the people who work in the dorms, the advisors, and then there might be support groups and outreach events around eating disorder awareness and recovery. So these are some questions that I recommend asking. Does your campus offer mental health services on campus? And if so, is there a session limit? Does the counseling center have staff who can help provide off-campus referrals? So this might work in conjunction with your insurance company, if it's Cigna, with their case managers helping with referrals. What is the student-to-staff ratio at the counseling center? Are there therapists who specialize in the treatment of eating disorders? Does the counseling center offer a therapist-led support group for students struggling with food? This can be really helpful in just making college students feel less alienated and more understood on campus. Does your campus have a student health center? And what are the services available there? Are the health center staff trained in the treatment of eating disorders? What kind of outreach to educate students about eating disorders is facilitated by the college? Is nutritional counseling available via the student health center or otherwise on campus? What kind of training does your student housing staff receive on how to best support students with mental health problems? What process is followed if a resident advisor notices that someone is struggling? And if I'm a parent, I would want to know, what would trigger me being called? Would I be called if my kid is suffering from any kind of mental health disorder? If a student requires medical leave of absence, who can they contact, and what is the process involved? So what's that going to mean if they need to get a higher level of care and need to take a break from school for a while? Will they be able to come back to campus? And the last question I have is, are student-run support groups for people with eating disorders available on campus? And with that, I will go to Q&A. Oh, now I have listed some resource recommendations at the end of these slides, some websites and some books that I think are helpful. And with that, I will conclude my presentation and go to questions and answers.
Thank you. At this time, we will conduct a brief survey. After I finish reading the entire question and all of the possible responses, please answer by pressing the star key followed by the number that corresponds to your choice. To help us evaluate and improve our program, please complete the following short survey. If you are a Cigna employee, we ask that you please refrain from participating in this survey. After the last question, there will be an opportunity for you to ask questions. Your individual responses will be kept confidential. Question number one. This session provided me with a better understanding of how eating disorders develop. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. And star 4, strongly disagree. Please stand by while we allow everyone a chance to respond. Question number two. This session educated me on red flags and interventions for college students who may be at risk for an eating disorder. Star 1 for strongly agree, star 2 agree, star 3 disagree, and star 4 strongly disagree. Once again, we'll allow a moment for everyone a chance to signal. Question number three. Overall, this session met my expectations. Star 1, strongly agree. Star 2, agree. Star 3, disagree. Star 4, strongly disagree. Our fourth question. I would recommend this program to others. 1, agree. Star 2, disagree. And our fifth question, please select a response that best describes your role in the life of an individual with an eating disorder. Star 1, I am an individual with an eating disorder. Star 2, I am a family member of someone with an eating disorder. Star 3, I am a health professional, or star 4, other. That concludes today's survey. Thank you, everyone, for your participation. We'll now go to our question and answer session. At this time, if you have a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Please make sure that your mute function is not pressed to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, that's star 1 if you have a question at this time. Again, that's star 1 if you have a question, star 1 on your telephone keypad. There appears to be no questions in the queue at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back over to our moderators for any closing remarks.
Hey, thank you, everyone, for attending today, and a special thank you again to Dr. Sarah Chips for providing us with such wonderful insights. If you have any specific questions about the topics discussed today, please contact the Eating Disorder team by calling the number on the back of your insurance card. Please also mark your calendars to join us next month on Tuesday, September 23rd at 1 p.m. Eastern, when the topic will be related to treating mood, anxiety, and eating disorders. Thank you for attending, and have a great day.